This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Under the Tuscan Sun by Francis Mayes.
What are you growing here? The upholsterer lugs an armchair up the walkway to the house, but his quick eyes are on the land. Olives and grapes, I answer. Of course olives and grapes, but what else? Herbs, flowers, we're not here in spring to plant much else. He puts the chair down on the damp grass and scans the carefully pruned olive trees on the terraces where we are now uncovering and restoring the former vineyard. Grow potatoes, he advises. They'll take care of themselves. He points to the third terrace. There, full sun, the right place for potatoes. Red potatoes, yellow. Potatoes for gnocchi di patate. And so at the beginning of our fifth summer here, we now dig the potatoes for our dinner. They come up so easily, it's like finding Easter eggs. I'm surprised how clean they are. Just a rinse and they shine. The way we have potatoes is the way most everything has come about, as we've transformed this abandoned Tuscan house and land over the past 4 years. We watch Francesco Falco, who has spent most of his 75 years attending to grapes, bury the tendril of an old vine so that it shoots out new growth. We do the same. The grapes thrive. As foreigners who have landed here by grace, we'll try anything. Much of the restoration we did ourselves, an accomplishment, as my grandfather would say, out of the fullness of our ignorance. In 1990, our first summer here, I bought an oversized blank book with Florentine paper covers and blue leather binding. On the first page I wrote, Italy. The book looked as though it should have immortal poetry in it, but I began with lists of wildflowers, new words, sketches of tile in Pompeii. I described rooms, trees, bird calls. I added planting advice, plant sunflowers when the moon crosses Libra, although I had no clue myself as to when that might be. I wrote about the people we met and the food we cooked. The book became a chronicle of our first 4 years here. Today it is stuffed with menus, postcards of paintings, Italian poems, and diagrams of the garden. Because it is thick, I still have room in it for a few more summers. Now the blue book has become Under the Tuscan Sun, a natural outgrowth of my first pleasures here. Restoring, then improving the house, transforming an overgrown jungle into a farm for olives and grapes, exploring the layers and layers of Tuscany and Umbria, cooking in a foreign kitchen, and discovering the many links between the food and the culture. These intense joys frame the deeper pleasure of learning to live another kind of life. To bury the grape tendril in such a way that it shoots out new growth, I recognize easily as a metaphor for the way life must change from time to time if we are to go forward in our thinking. Italy is thousands of years deep, and on the top layer I am standing on a small plot of land, delighted today with the wild orange lilies spotting the hillside. While I'm admiring them, an old man stops in the road and asks if I live here. He tells me he knows the land well. He pauses and looks along the stone wall, then, in a quiet voice, tells me his brother was shot here, aged 17, suspected of being a partisan. He keeps nodding his head, and I know the scene he looks at is not my rose garden, my hedge of sage and lavender. He has moved beyond me. He blows me a kiss. Bella casa, signora. Yesterday I found a patch of blue cornflowers around an olive tree where his brother must have fallen. Where did they come from? A seed dropped by a thrush? Will they spread next year over the crest of the terrace? Old places exist on sine waves of time and space that bend in some logarithmic motion I'm beginning to ride. I open the blue book. Writing about this place, our discoveries, wanderings, and daily life, has been a pleasure. A Chinese poet many centuries ago noticed that to recreate something in words is like being alive twice. At the taproot, to seek change probably always is related to the desire to enlarge the psychic space one lives in. My listener, I hope, is like a friend who comes to visit, learns to mound flour on the thick marble counter and work in the egg. A friend who wakes to the four calls of the cuckoo in the linden and walks down the terrace path singing to the grapes. Who picks jars of plums, drives with me to hill towns of round towers and spilling geraniums. Who wants to see the olives the first day they are olives. A guest on holiday is intent on pleasure. Feel the breeze rushing around those hot marble statues. Like old peasants, we could sit by the fireplace, grilling slabs of bread and oil, pour a young Chianti, after rooms of Renaissance virgins and dusty back roads from Umbertide, I cook a pan of small eels fried with garlic and sage. Under the fig where two cats curl, we're cool. I've counted. The dove coos 60 times per minute. The Etruscan wall above the house dates from the 8th century B.C. We can talk. We have time. Bramare, archaic, to yearn for. I'm about to buy a house in a foreign country, a house with the beautiful name of Bramasole. It is tall, square, and apricot-colored, with faded green shutters, ancient tile roof, and an iron balcony on the second level, where ladies might have sat with their fans to watch some spectacle below. But below, overgrown briars, tangles of roses, and knee-high weeds run rampant. The balcony faces southeast, looking into a deep valley, then into the Tuscan Apennines. When it rains or when the light changes, the facade of the house turns gold, sienna, ochre. A previous scarlet paint job seeps through in rosy spots, like a box of crayons left to melt in the sun. In places where the stucco has fallen away, rugged stone shows what the exterior once was. The house rises above a strada bianca, a road white with pebbles, on a terraced slab of hillside covered with fruit and olive trees. Bramasole, from Bramare, to yearn for, and sole, sun, something that yearns for the sun, and yes, I do. The family wisdom runs strongly against this decision. My mother has said ridiculous, with her certain and forceful stress on the second syllable, ridiculous, and my sisters, although excited, fear I am 18, about to run off with a sailor in the family car. I quietly have my own doubts. Upright seats in the notaio's outer office don't help. Through my thin white linen dress, spiky horsehairs pierce me every time I shift, which is often in the 100-degree waiting room. I look over to see what Ed is writing on the back of a receipt. Parmesan, salami, coffee, bread. How can he? Finally, the signora opens her door, and her torrential Italian flows over us. The notaio is nothing like a notary. She's a legal person who conducts real estate transactions in Italy. Ours, Signora Mantucci, talks faster than any human I have ever heard. She reads long laws aloud. Ed looks at her raptly. I know he's enthralled to the sound of her voice. The owner, Dr. Carter, suddenly thinks he has asked too little. He must have, since we have agreed to buy it. We think his price is exorbitant. We know his price is exorbitant. The owner expects to claim that the house costs one amount, while it really costs much more. That is just the way it's done, he insists. No one is fool enough to declare the real value. He proposes we bring in one check to the notaio's office, then pass him 10 smaller checks, literally under the table. Anselmo Martini, our agent, shrugs. Ian, the English estate agent we hired to help with translation, shrugs also. Dr. Carter concludes, "You Americans, you take things so seriously, and per favore, date the checks at one-week intervals so the bank isn't alerted to large sums." Was that the same bank I know, whose slow-eyed teller languidly conducts a transaction every 15 minutes between smokes and telephone calls. The signora comes to an abrupt halt, scrambles the papers into a folder, and stands up. We are to come back when the money and papers are ready. A window in our hotel room opens onto an expansive view over the ancient roofs of Cortona, down to the dark expanse of the Val di Chiana. A hot and wild wind, the Scirocco, is driving normal people a little crazy. For me, it seems to reflect my state of mind. I can't sleep. In the United States, I've bought and sold a few houses. You have to churn somewhat when the roof covering your head is at stake, since to sell is to walk away from a cluster of memories, and to buy is to choose where the future will take place. And the place, never neutral, of course, will cast its influence. Here, absolutely everything conspires to keep me staring into the dark. Italy always has had a magnetic north pull on my psyche. Houses have been on my mind for 4 summers of renting farmhouses all over Tuscany. The circuitous search for a permanent summer home became a quest for us. Whether we ever found a place or not, we were happening on places that made pure green olive oil, discovering sweet country Romanesque churches and villages, meandering the back roads of vineyards, and stopping to taste the softest Brunello and the blackest Vino Nobile. Looking for a house gives an intense focus. We visited weekly markets, not just with the purchase of picnic peaches in mind. We looked carefully at all the produce's quality and variety, mentally forecasting birthday dinners, new holidays, and breakfast for weekend guests. We spent hours sitting in piazzas, secretly getting a sense of the place's ambience. I soaked many a heel blister in a hotel bidet, rubbed bottles of lotion onto my feet, which had covered miles of stony streets. We hauled histories and wildflower books and novels in and out of rented houses and hotels. Always, we asked local people where they liked to eat and headed to restaurants our many guidebooks never mentioned. Cortona was the first town we ever stayed in, and we always came back to it during the summers we rented near Volterra, Florence, Montisi, Rignano, Vicchio, Querce Grossa, all those fascinating, quirky houses. One had a kitchen 2 people could not pass in, but there was a slice of a view of the Arno. Another kitchen had no hot water and no knives, but the house was built into medieval ramparts overlooking vineyards. We drove hundreds of dusty miles looking at houses that turned out to be in the floodplain of the Tiber or overlooking strip mines. A sawtooth peasant we met in a bar tried to sell us his childhood home, a windowless stone chicken house joined to another house with snarling dogs lunging at us from their ropes. We fell hard for a farm outside Montisi. The Contessa who owned it led us on for days, then decided she needed a sign from God before she could sell it. We had to leave before the sign arrived. As I think back over those places, they suddenly seem preposterously alien, and Cortona does too. Ed doesn't think so. He's in the piazza every afternoon, steeping in the piazza life, the sultry and buffed man pushing up his sleeves so his muscles show when he languidly props his chin in his hand, the pure flute notes of Vivaldi drifting from an upstairs window, the flower seller's fan of bright flowers against the stone shop. Finally, he takes a stroll, memorizing the stones in the street. Across the hotel courtyard, a visiting Arab chants his prayers toward dawn, just when I finally can fall asleep. I look out, see him nodding in the window, a sweet smile on his face. He reminds me so much of tobacco auctioneers I heard in hot warehouses in the South as a child. I am 7,000 miles from home, plunking down my life savings on a whim. Is it a whim? It feels very close to falling in love, and that's never really whimsical, but comes from some deep source. Or does it? Each time we step out of the cool high rooms of the hotel and into the sharp-edged sun, We like Cortona more and more. A few farmers sell produce on the steps of the 19th Century Teatro every morning. As we drink espresso, we watch them holding up rusty hand scales to weigh the tomatoes. The rest of the piazza is lined with perfectly intact medieval or Renaissance palazzi. Every day we visit each keystone medieval gate in the Etruscan walls, explore the fiat-wide stone streets lined with Renaissance and older houses. I notice in the doors, people often leave their keys in the lock. Guidebooks describe Cortona as somber and austere. They misjudge. The hilltop position, the walls and upright massive stone buildings give a distinctly vertical feel to the architecture. Walking across the piazza, I feel the abrupt, angular shadows fall with Euclidean purity. I want to stand up straight. The upright posture of the buildings seems to carry over to the inhabitants. They walk slowly with very fine, I want to say, carriage. I keep saying, isn't she beautiful? Isn't he gorgeous? Look at that face. Pure Raphael. By afternoon, we're sitting again with our espressi, facing the other piazza. A woman of about 60, with her daughter and the teenage granddaughter, pass by us, strolling, their arms linked, sun on their vibrant faces. We don't know why light has such a luminous quality. Perhaps the sunflower crops radiate gold from the surrounding fields. The three women look peaceful, proud, impressively pleased. There should be a gold coin with their faces on it. Meanwhile, as we sip, the dollar is falling fast. Every 100 lira it falls, we calculate how much more expensive the house becomes. Typically, the banks vary in how much commission they bite when they receive a large transfer from overseas. We want a break. It looks like a significant chunk of interest they'll collect, since clearing a check in Italy can take weeks. Finally, we have a lesson in the way things work. Dr. Carter, anxious to close, calls his bank, the bank his father and his father-in-law use, in Arezzo, half an hour away. Then he calls us. Go there, he says. They won't take a commission for receiving the money at all. And they'll give you whatever the posted rate is when it arrives. His savvy doesn't surprise me, though he has seemed spectacularly uninterested in money the entire time we have negotiated, just named his high price and stuck to it. He bought the property from 5 old sisters of a land-owning family in Perugia the year before, thinking, he said, to make it a summer place for his family. However, he and his wife inherited property on the coast and decided to use that instead. Was that the case, or had he scooped up a bargain from ladies in their 90s and now is making a bundle, possibly buying coast property with our money? Not that I begrudge him. He's smart. Dr. Carter, perhaps fearing we might back out, calls and asks to meet us at the house. He roars up in his Alpha 164, Armani, from stem to stern. There's something more, he says, as though continuing a conversation. If you follow me, I will show you something. A few 100 yards down the road, he leads us up a stone path through fragrant yellow broom. Soon we come to a 200-degree view of the valley, with a cypress-lined road below us and a mellow landscape dotted with tended vineyards and olive groves. In the distance lies a blue dab which is Lake Trasimeno. Off to the right, we see the red-roofed silhouette of Cortona cleanly outlined against the sky. Dr. Carter turns to us triumphantly. The flat paving stones widen here. The Romans, he says. This road was built by the Romans. It goes straight into Cortona. The sun is brawling. He points out where the rest of the road might have run, right through Bramasoli's property. Back at the house, he turns on an outside faucet and splashes his face. You'll enjoy the finest water, truly your own abundant acqua minerale, excellent for the liver, eccellente, enough water for a swimming pool, he insists, which would be perfect out on the point where you can see the lake, overlooking right where Hannibal defeated the Romans. We're dazzled by the remains of a Roman road over the hill covered with wildflowers. We will follow the stone road into town for coffee late in the afternoons. He shows us the old cistern. Water is precious in Tuscany and was collected drop by drop. By shining a flashlight into the opening, we've already noticed that the underground cistern has a stone archway, obviously some kind of passageway. Up the hill in the Medici fortress, we saw the same arch in the cistern there, and the caretaker told us that a secret underground escape route goes downhill to the valley, then to Lake Trasimeno. Italians take such remains casually. That one is allowed to own such ancient things seems impossible to me. When I first saw Bramasole, I immediately wanted to hang my summer clothes in an armadio and arrange my books under one of those windows looking out over the valley. We'd spent 4 days driving around with Signor Martini, who had a dark little office on Via Sacco e Vanzetti down in the lower town, and had nearly given up. Nothing he showed us was right. Finally, out of Cortona, he took the road that climbs and winds to the other side of the hill. He turned onto the Strada Bianca, and after a couple of kilometers, pulled into a long, sloping driveway. I caught a glimpse of a shrine, then looked up at the three-story house with a curly iron fanlight above the front door and two tall, exotic palm trees on either side. On that fresh morning, the facade seemed radiant, glazed with layers of lemon, rouge, and terracotta. We both became silent as we got out of the car. "Perfect, we'll take it," I joked, as we stepped through the weeds. Just as he had at other houses, Signor Martini made no sales pitch. He simply looked with us. We walked up to the house under a rusted pergola, leaning under the weight of climbing roses. The double front door squawked like something alive when we pushed it open. The house's walls, thick as my arm is long, radiated coolness. The glass in the windows wavered. I scuffed through silty dust and saw below it smooth brick floors in perfect condition. In each room, Ed opened the inside window and pushed open the shutters to one glorious view after another of cypresses, rippling green hills, a valley. There were even two bathrooms that functioned. They were not beautiful, but bathrooms, after all the houses we'd seen with no floors, much less plumbing. No one had lived there in 30 years, and the ground seemed like an enchanted garden, overgrown and tumbling with blackberries and vines. I could see Signor Martini regarding the grounds with a countryman's practiced eye. Ivy twisted into the trees and ran over fallen terrace walls. "Molto lavoro, much work," was all he said. During several years of looking, sometimes casually, sometimes to the point of exhaustion, I never heard a house say yes so completely. However, we were leaving the next day, and when we learned the price, we sadly said no and went home. During the next months, I mentioned Bramasole now and then. I stuck a photo on my mirror and often wandered the grounds or rooms in my mind. The house is a metaphor for the self, of course, but it is also totally real. And a foreign house exaggerates all the associations houses carry. Because I had ended a long marriage that was not supposed to end and was establishing a new relationship, this house quest felt tied to whatever new identity I would manage to forge. When the flying fur from the divorce settled, I had found myself with a grown daughter, a full-time university job, a modest securities portfolio, and an entire future to invent. I had the urge to examine my life in another culture and move beyond what I knew. Ed shares my passion for Italy completely, and also shares the boon of 3 month summer breaks from university teaching. There we would have long days for exploring and for our writing and research projects. The new life might shape itself to the contours of the house, which already is at home in the landscape, and to the rhythms around it. In the spring, I called a California woman who was starting a real estate development business in Tuscany. I asked her to check on Bramasole. Perhaps if it had not sold, the price had come down. A week later, She called from a bar after meeting with the owner. Yes, it's still for sale, but with that particular brand of Italian logic, the price has been raised. The dollar, she reminded me, has fallen, and that house needs a lot of work. Now we've returned. By this time, with equally peculiar logic, I've become fixed on buying Bramasole. After all, the only thing wrong is the expense. We both love the setting, the house, the town, and the land. If only one little thing is wrong, I tell myself, go ahead. Still, this costs a sacco di soldi. It will be an enormous hassle to recover the house and land from neglect. Leaks, mold, tumbling stone terraces, crumbling plaster, one funky bathroom, another with an adorable metal hip bathtub, and a cracked toilet. Why does the prospect seem fun when I found remodeling my kitchen in San Francisco a deep shock to my equilibrium? At home, we can't even hang a picture without knocking out a fistful of plaster. On the other hand, a dignified house near an Etruscan wall, a Medici fortress in sight, 117 olive trees, 20 plums, and still uncounted apricot, almond, apple, and pear trees. Several figs seem to thrive near the well. Beside the front steps, there's a large hazelnut. Then proximity to one of the most superb towns I've ever seen. Wouldn't we be crazy not to buy this lovely house called Bramasole? What if one of us is hit by a potato chip truck and can't work? I run through the litany of diseases we could get. An aunt died of a heart attack at 42. My grandmother went blind. All the ugly illnesses. What if an earthquake shakes down the universities where we teach? I leap out of bed at 3 a.m. and step in the shower, letting my whole face take the cold water. Coming back to bed in the dark, feeling my way, I jam my toe on the iron bed frame. Pain jags all the way up my backbone. Ed, wake up. I think I've broken my toe. How can you sleep? He sits up. I was just dreaming of cutting herbs in the garden. Sage and lemon balm. Sage is salvia in Italian. He has never wavered from his belief that this is a brilliant idea, that this is heaven on earth. He clicks on the bedside lamp. He's smiling. My half-own toenail is hanging half off, ugly purple spreading underneath. I can't bear to leave it or to pull it off. I want to go home, I say. He puts a band-aid around my toe. You mean Bramasole, don't you? He asks. What is this thrall for houses? I come from a long line of women who open their handbags and take out swatches of upholstery material, colored squares of bathroom tile, seven shades of yellow paint samples, and strips of flowered wallpaper. We love the concept of four walls. What is her house like, my sister asks, and we both know she means, what is she like? I love the islands off the Georgia coast, where I spent summers when I was growing up. Why not buy a weathered gray house there made of wood that looks as though it washed up on the beach? Cotton rugs, peach iced tea, a watermelon cooling in the creek, sleeping with waves churning and rolling outside the window. But I keep remembering that any time I've stepped in my own footprints again, I haven't felt renewed. Though I'm susceptible to the pull to the known, I'm just slightly more susceptible to surprise. Italy seems endlessly alluring to me. Why not at this point consider the opening of the Divine Comedy? What must one do in order to grow? Best to remember my father. The family motto, he'd say, is packing and unpacking. And also, if you can't go first class, don't go at all. Lying awake, I feel the familiar sense of the answer arriving. Like answers on the bottom of the black fortune-telling eight ball that I loved when I was 10, often I can feel an idea or the solution to a dilemma floating up through murky liquid. Then it is as if I see the suddenly clear white writing. I like the charged zone of waiting, a mental and physical sensation of the bends as something mysterious zigzags to the surface of consciousness. What if you did not feel uncertainty, the white writing says? Are you exempt from doubt? Why not rename it excitement? Think, what if the sky doesn't fall? What if it's glorious? What if the house is transformed in 3 years? There will be by then thin linen curtains pulled across the shutters for siesta, jars of plum jam on the shelves, a long table for feast under the linden trees, baskets piled by the doors for picking tomatoes, arugula, wild fennel, roses, and rosemary. And who are we in that strange new life? Finally, the money arrives. The account is open. We're gathered in the notaio's office for the final reckoning. It's quick. Everyone talks at once and no one listens. The Baroque legal terms leave us way behind. A jackhammer outside drills into my brain cells. There's something about two oxen in 2 days. Ian, who's translating, stops to explain this archaic spiral of language as an 18th century legal description of the amount of land measured by how long it would take two oxen to plow it. We have, it seems, 2 plowing days worth of property. I write checks, my fingers cramping over all the times I write milione. I think of all the nice, dependable bonds and utility stocks and blue chips from the years of my marriage magically turning into a terraced hillside and a big empty house. The glass house in California where I lived for a decade, surrounded by kumquat, lemon, mock orange, and guava, its bright pool and covered patio with wicker and flowered cushions, all seemed to recede as though seen through the long focus in binoculars. Is that a little cat smile on the mouth of the owner's wife? We're expecting a parchment deed lettered in ancient script, but no, the notaio is going on vacation, and she'll try to get to the paperwork before she leaves. Normale, Signor Martini says. I've noticed all along that someone's word is still taken for that. Endless contracts and stipulations and contingencies simply have not come up. Ed and I walk out into the brutally hot afternoon with nothing but 2 heavy iron keys, longer than my hand, one to a rusted iron gate, the other to the front door. The car is as hot as a pizza oven. We sit there with the doors open, suddenly laughing and laughing. We'd arranged for 2 women to clean and for a bed to be delivered while we signed the final papers. In town, we picked up a bottle of cold Prosecco, then stopped at the rosticceria for marinated zucchini, olives, roast chicken, and potatoes. We arrive at the house, dazed by events. Anna and Lucia have washed the windows and exorcised layers of dust, as well as many spiders' webs. The second-floor bedroom that opens onto a brick terrace gleams. They've made the bed with new blue sheets and left the terrace door open to the sound of cuckoos and wild canaries in the linden trees. We pick the last of the pink roses on the front terrace and fill 2 old Chianti bottles with them. The shuttered room, with its whitewashed walls, just waxed floors, pristine bed with new sheets, all lit with a dangling 40-watt bulb, seems as pure as a Franciscan cell. As soon as I walk in, I think it is the most perfect room in the world. We shower and dress in fresh clothes. In the quiet twilight, we sit on the stone wall of the terrace and toast each other and the house with tumblers of the spicy Prosecco, which seems like a liquid form of the air. We toast the cypress trees along the road and the white horse in the neighbor's field, the villa in the distance that was built for the visit of a pope. The olive pits we toss over the wall, hoping they will spring from the ground next year. Dinner is delicious. As the darkness comes, a barn owl flies over so close that we hear the whir of wings, and when it settles in the black locust, a strange cry that we take for a greeting. The constellations pop out clear as a star chart. When it finally is dark, we see that the Milky Way sweeps right over the house. I forget the stars, living in the ambient light of a city. Here they are all along, spangling and dense, falling and pulsating. We stare up until our necks ache. The Milky Way looks like a flung bolt of lace unfurling. Ed, because he likes to whisper, leans to my ear. "Still want to go home?" he asks. "Or can this be home?" A house and the land it takes 2 oxen 2 days to plow. I admire the beauty of scorpions. They look like black ink hieroglyphs of themselves. I'm fascinated, too, that they can navigate by the stars, though how they ever glimpse constellations from their usual homes in dusty corners of vacant houses, I don't know. One scurries around in the bidet every morning. Several get sucked up into the new vacuum cleaner by mistake, though usually they are luckier. I trap them in a jar and take them outside. I suspect every cup and shoe. When I fluff a bed pillow, an albino one lands on my bare shoulder. We upset armies of spiders as we empty the closet under the stairs of its bottle collection. Impressive the long threads for legs and the fly-sized bodies. I can even see their eyes. Other than these inhabitants, the inheritance from the former occupants consists of dusty wine bottles. We fill local recycling bins over and over, waterfalls of glass raining from boxes we've loaded and reloaded. The stalls in Lemania, a garage-sized room once used for storing pots of lemons over the winter, are piled with rusty pans, newspapers from 1958, wire, paint cans, debris. I look for old photos or antique spoons but see nothing of interest except some handmade iron tools. One cunningly made tool, an elegant little sculpture, is a hand-sized crescent with a worn chestnut handle. Any Tuscan would recognize it in a second, a tool for trimming grapes. The Cortinese, out for afternoon strolls, pause in the road and look up at all the mad activity, the car trunk full of bottles, me screaming as a scorpion falls down my shirt when I sweep the stone walls of the stall, Ed wielding a grim reaper scythe through the weeds. Sometimes they stop and call up, "How much did you pay for the house?" I'm taken aback and charmed by the bluntness. "Probably too much," I answer. One person remembered that long ago an artist from Naples lived there. For most, it has stood empty as far back as they can remember. Every day we haul and scrub. We have bought cleaning supplies, a new stove and fridge. With sawhorses and 2 planks, we set up a kitchen counter. Although we must bring hot water from the bathroom in a plastic laundry pan, we have a surprisingly manageable kitchen. As one who has used Williams-Sonoma as a toy store for years, I begin to get back to an elementary sense of the kitchen. 3 wooden spoons, 2 for the salad, 1 for stirring, a sauté pan, bread knife, cutting knife, cheese grater, pasta pot, baking dish, and stovetop espresso pot. We brought over some old picnic silverware and bought a few glasses and plates. Those first pastas are divine. After long work, we eat everything in sight, then tumble like field hands into bed. Our favorite is spaghetti with an easy sauce made from diced pancetta, unsmoked bacon, quickly browned then stirred into cream, and chopped wild arugula, which is called rughetta locally and is easily available in our driveway and along the stone walls. We grate Parmigiano on top and eat huge mounds. Besides the best salad of all, those amazing tomatoes sliced thickly and served with chopped basil and mozzarella, we learn to make Tuscan white beans with sage and olive oil. We consume an astonishing number of black olives. 3 ingredients is about all we manage most nights, but that seems to be enough for something splendid. The idea of cooking here inspires me. With such superb ingredients, everything seems easy. An abandoned slab of marble from a dresser top serves as a pastry table when I decide to make my own crust for a plum tart. I roll it out with one of the hand-blown Chianti bottles I rescued from the debris. Late in the afternoons, I take long soaks in the hip bath filled with bubbles, washing spider webs out of my hair, grit from my nails, necklaces of dirt from around my neck. I've not had a necklace of dirt since I used to play kick the can on long summer evenings as a child. Ed emerges reborn from the shower, tan in his white cotton shirt and khaki shorts. The empty house, now scrubbed, feels spacious and pure. Most of the scorpions migrate elsewhere. Because of the thick stone walls, we feel cool even on the hottest days. A primitive farm table left in the Limonaya becomes our dining table on the front terrace. We sit outside talking late about the restoration, savoring the gorgonzola with a pear pulled off the tree, and the wine from Lake Trasimeno just a valley away. Renovation seems simple, really. A central water heater with a new bath and existing baths rooted to it, new kitchen, but simple, soul of simplicity. How long will the permits take? Do we really need central heat? Should the kitchen stay where it is, or wouldn't it really be better where the ox stall currently is? That way, the present kitchen could be the living room, with a big fireplace in it. In the dark, we can see the shadowy vestiges of a formal garden, a long, overgrown boxwood hedge, with five huge, ragged topiary balls rising out of it. Should we rebuild the garden with these strange remnants, cut them out of the hedge, take out the ancient hedge altogether and plant something informal, such as lavender? I close my eyes and try to have a vision of the garden in 3 years. But the overgrown jungle is too indelibly imprinted in my brain. By the end of dinner, I could sleep standing up like a horse. A lifelong insomniac, I sleep like one newly dead every night and dream deeply harmonious dreams of swimming along with the current in a clear green river, playing and at home in the water. On the first night, I dreamed that the real name of the house was not Brahmasole, but Cento Angeli, 100 Angels, and that I would discover them one by one. Is it bad luck to change the name of a house as it is to rename a boat? As a trepid foreigner, I wouldn't. But for me, the house now has a secret name as well as its own name. The bottles are gone, the house is clean, the tile floors shine with a waxy patina. We hang a few hooks on the backs of doors just to get our clothes out of suitcases. With milk crates and a few squares of marble left in the stall, we fashion a couple of bedside tables to go with our two chairs from the garden center. We feel prepared to face the reality of restoration. We walk into town for coffee and telephone Piero Rizzatti, the geometra. The translation's draftsman or surveyor don't quite explain what a geometra is, a professional without an equivalent in the United States, a liaison among owner, builders, and town planning officials. Ian has assured us that he is the best in the area, meaning also that he has the best connections and can get the permits quickly. The next day, Ian drives out with Signor Rizzatti and his tape measure and notepad. We begin our cold-eyed tour through the empty house. The bottom floor is basically five rooms in a row: farmer's kitchen, main kitchen, living room, horse stall, another stall, with a hall and stairs after the first two rooms. The house is bisected by its great stairwell with stone steps and hand-wrought iron railing. A strange floor plan. The house is designed like a dollhouse, one room deep, with all the rooms about the same size. That seems to me like giving all your children the same name. On the upper two floors, there are two bedrooms on either side of the stairs. You must go through the first room to get to the other. Privacy, until recently, wasn't much of an issue for Italian families. Even Michelangelo, I recall, slept four abed with his masons when he worked on a project. In the great Florentine Palazzi, you must go through one immense room to get to the next. Corridors must have seemed a waste of space. The west end of the house, one room on each floor, is walled off for the contadini, the farm family who worked the olive and grape terraces. A narrow stone stairway runs up the back of that apartment, and there's no entrance from the main house except through that kitchen's front door. There are four French doors across the front of the house. I envision them with new shutters all flung open to the terrace, lavender, roses, and pots of lemons between them, with lovely scents wafting into the house, and a natural movement of inside-outside living. Signor Rizzatti turns the handle of the farm kitchen door, and it comes off in his hand. A crude room with a toilet cemented to the floor, one step above a privy, is tacked on to the third floor of the house. The farmers, with no running water upstairs, must have used a bucket flush method. The two real bathrooms are also built off the back of the house, each one at a stair landing. This ugly solution is still common for stone houses constructed before indoor plumbing. The small bath, which I take to be the house's first, has a low ceiling, stone checkerboard floor, and the charming hip bath. The large bathroom must have been added in the 50s, not long before the house was abandoned. Someone had a dizzy fling with tile, floor to ceiling, pink, blue, and white in a butterfly design. The shower simply drains into the floor, that is to say, water spreads all over the bathroom. Someone attached the shower head so high on the wall that the spray creates a breeze and the angled shower curtain we hung wraps around our legs. We walk out onto the L-shaped terrace off the second-floor bedroom, leaning onto the railing for the stupendous view of the valley from one direction and of fruit and olive trees from the others. We're imagining, of course, future breakfast here with overhanging apricot tree in bloom and the hillside covered with wild irises. The terrace floor is just like the floors in the house, only the tile is beautifully weathered and mossy. Signor Rizzotti, however, regards the tiles with a frown. When we go downstairs, he points to the ceiling of the limonaia just underneath the terrace, which also is caked with moss and is even crumbling in some spots. Leaks. This looks expensive. The scrawls on his notepad cover 2 pages. We think the weird layout suits us. We don't need 8 bedrooms anyway. Each of the 4 can have an adjoining study or sitting room, although we decide to turn the room next to ours into a bathroom. 2 bathrooms seem enough, but we'd love the luxury of a private bath next to the bedroom. If we can chop out the farmer's crude toilet attached to that room, we'll have a closet off the bath, the only one in the house. With his metal tape, the geometer indicates the ghost of a door leading into the farmer's former bedroom from the bedroom we'll have. Reopening it, we think, will be a quick job. On the bottom floor, the line of rooms is not that convenient. When we first saw the house, I'd said airily, "We can knock those walls out and have 2 big rooms down here." Now our geometer tells us we may open the walls only about 6 feet because of earthquake precautions. The geometer is full of opinions. He thinks the apartment's back staircase should come out. We love it, a secret escape. He thinks we should replaster the cracked and crumbling stucco facade, paint it ochre. No way, I like the colors that change as the light does, and the intense glow of gold when it rains, as though the sun seeps into the walls. He thinks our first priority should be the roof. But the roof doesn't leak. Why bother it when there's so many other pressing things? We explain to him that we won't be able to do everything at once. The house costs the earth. The project will have to be spread out. We will do much of the work ourselves. Americans, I try to explain, sometimes are do-it-yourself people. As I say this, I see a flash of panic cross Ed's face. Do-it-yourself doesn't translate. The geometer shakes his head as though all is hopeless if he has to explain things as basic as these. He speaks to us kindly, as if through precise enunciation we will understand him. Listen, the roof must be consolidated. They will preserve the tiles, place them again in the same order, but you will have insulation. The roof will be strengthened. At this point, it's either the roof or central heating, not both. We debate the importance of each. We decide on the heating. The geometer, feeling sure that we will come to our senses, says he will apply for a roof permit as well. At some low point in the house's life, someone madly painted the chestnut beams in every room with a hideous vinegar varnish. This unimaginable technique once was popular in the south of Italy. You paint over real beams with a sticky goo, then comb through it to simulate wood. Sandblasting, therefore, is a top priority. An ugly job, but fast, and we'll do the sealing and waxing ourselves. I once refinished a sailor's sea chest and found it fun. We'll need door and window repairs. All the window casements and interior shutters are covered with the same faux wood concoction. This genius of the beams and windows is probably responsible for the fireplace, which is covered with ceramic tiles that resemble bricks. What a strange mind to cover the real thing with an imitation of something real. All this must go, along with the blue tiles covering the wide windowsill, the butterflies in the bathroom. Both the main kitchen and the farmer's kitchen sport ugly cement sinks. His list is now 3 pages long. The farmer's kitchen has floors made of crushed marble tiles, super ugly. There are a lot of ancient-looking wires coiled near the ceilings on white porcelain knobs. Sometimes sparks come flying out when I switch on a light. The geometer sits on the terrace wall, mopping his face with an enormous monogrammed linen handkerchief. He looks at us with pity. Rule 1 in a restoration project, be there. We will be 7,000 miles away when some of the big work is done. We brace ourselves. Our geometer recommends a contractor, Primo Bianchi, who arrives in an Ape, one of those miniature three-wheeled trucks. He, too, is miniature, scarcely 5 feet tall, stout and dressed in overalls with a red kerchief around his neck. He rolls out and salutes us formally with an old word, Salve, signori. He looks like one of Santa's workers with gold-rimmed glasses, flyaway white hair, tall boots. Permesso, he asks, before we go through the door. At each door he pauses and repeats, Permesso, as though he might surprise someone undressing. He holds his cap in his hand in a way I recognize from my father's mill workers in the South. He's used to being the peasant, speaking to the padrone. He has, however, a confident sense of himself, a pride I often notice in waiters, mechanics, and delivery people here. He tries the window latches and swings the doors, pokes the tip of his knife in beams to check for rot, wiggles loose bricks. He comes to a spot in the floor, kneels and rubs 2 bricks that are a slightly lighter color. Io, he says, beaming, pointing to his chest. Molti anni fa. He replaced them many years ago. He then tells us he used to come every December and help haul the big lemon pots that line the terrace into the limonaia for the winter. The house's owner was his father's age, a widower then, whose 5 daughters had grown and moved away. When he died, the daughters left the house vacant. They refused to part with it, but no one cared for the place for 30 years. Ah, the 5 sisters of Perugia. I imagine in their narrow iron beds in 5 bedrooms, all waking at once and throwing open the shutters. I don't believe in ghosts, but from the beginning I sensed their heavy black braids twisted with ribbons, their white nightgowns embroidered with their initials, their mother with silver brushes lining them up before the mirror each night for 100 strokes. On the upstairs terrace, Primo shook his head. The bricks must come up. Then an underlay of tar paper and insulation installed. We had a feeling he knew what he was talking about. The central heating? Keep the fire going. Dress warmly, signora. The cost is formidable. Taking down the 2 walls? Yes, it could be done. We both knew Primo Bianchi was the right man for the restoration. If the gun is on the mantle in Chapter 1, there must be a bang by the end of the story. The former owner had not just affirmed the bounty of water, he had waxed lyrical. It was a subject of great pride. When he showed us around the property's borders, he had opened a garden faucet full blast, turning his hands in the cold well water. This was a watering spot for the Etruscans. This water is known to be the purest. The whole Medici water system, he said, gesturing to the walls of the 15th century fortress at the top of the hill, runs right through this land. His English was perfect. Without doubt, he knew about water. He described the watercourses of the mountains around us, the rich supply that flowed through our side of Mont Saint-Desidio. Of course, we had the property inspected before we bought it. An impartial geometer from Umbertide, miles away over the hills, gave us detailed evaluations. The water, he agreed, was plentiful. While I am taking a shower after 6 weeks of ownership, the water slows, then trickles, then drips, then stops. Soap in hand, I stand there without comprehension for several moments, then decide the pump must have been turned off accidentally, or more likely, the power's gone off. But the overhead light is on. I step out and rub off the soap with a towel. Signor Martini drives out from his office bringing a long string marked with meters and a weight on the end. We lift the stone off the well, and he lowers the weight. Poco acqua, he announces loudly as the weight hits bottom. Little water. He hauls the string up, black roots hanging off, and only a few inches are wet. The well is a measly 20 meters deep with a pump that must have ushered in the Industrial Revolution. That Tuscany is in the third year of a serious drought doesn't help either. Un nuovo pozzo, he announces still louder. A new well. Meanwhile, he says, we will buy water from a friend of his, who will bring it in a truck. Fortunately, he has a friend for every situation. Lake water, I ask, imagining little toads and slimy green weed from Trasimeno. He assures us it's pure water, even has fluoride in it. His friend simply will pump umpteen liters into the well, and it will be adequate for the rest of the summer. In fall, a new pozzo, deep, with fine water, enough for a swimming pool. And so we buy a truckload of water, feeling half foolish and half relieved. We only have 2 weeks left at Bramasole, and paying Martini's friend certainly is cheaper than going to a hotel and not nearly as humiliating. We shower fast, drink nothing but bottled water, and eat out frequently and enrich the dry cleaners. All day we hear the rhythmic pounding of well-drilling equipment rising from the valley below us. Others, it seems, don't have deep wells either. I wonder if anyone else in Italy ever has had a load of water dumped into the ground. I keep confusing pozzo, well, with pazzo, crazy, which is what we must be. By the time we start to get a grasp on what the place needs besides water, and who we are here, it's time to go. In California, students are buying their text, consulting their class schedules. We arrange for permit applications. The estimates are all astronomical. We'll have to do more of the work ourselves than I imagined. I remember getting a shock when I changed the switch plate on an electrical outlet in my study at home. Ed once put his foot through the ceiling when he climbed into the attic to check for a roof leak. We call Primo Bianchi and tell him we will be in touch when permits come through. Because permits require both local and national approval, the process takes months, even a year. We hope Rizzotti is as well connected as we have heard he is. Bramasole must stand empty for another winter. Leaving a dry well leaves a dry taste. When we see the former owner in the piazza just before we leave, he is congenial, his new Armani tossed over his shoulders. How is everything at Bramasole, he asks. Couldn't be better, I reply. We love everything about it. As I closed the house, I counted 17 windows, each with heavy outside shutters, and elaborate inside windows with swinging wooden panels, and 7 doors to lock. When I pulled in the shutters, each room was suddenly dark, except for combs of sunlight cast on the floor. The doors have iron bars to hook in place, all except the portone, the big front door, which closes with the iron key and, I suppose, makes the elaborate locking of the other doors and windows moot, since a determined thief easily could batter his way in, despite the solid thump, thump of the lock turning twice. But the house has stood here empty through 30 winters. What's one more? Light years away, it's morning in California. Light is spilling into the dining room where Sister the Cat is warming her fur on the table under the windows. Odd to pack a bag and drive away. Just leave the house standing there in the early morning light, one of my favorite times, as though we'd never been there at all. Sister Water, Brother